Cambridge English, Certificate of Proficiency in English. Listening. Test 1. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you are listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There will now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1.
What did you think of the exhibition, Desmond?
Some of it was okay. I think that to be successful, photographs of celebrities have to go beyond the obvious. Sure, it's about capturing the essential quality of an important moment, but it's also about the mundane, like in those photographs of rock and roll stars shopping in a German supermarket. They're trying to look fierce, but they come across as short on sleep and quite vulnerable. But at the same time, the photographer manages to make them rather alluring.
I think my favourite was the photograph of Princess Carla. There was a certain power in the way the photograph had been cropped to keep all that energy in a small space. And in a way, it's a double portrait because the photographer's shone a lamp on her face so that you see her shadow in profile just behind her on the wall. I like the way this seems to reflect her personality, the part of her personality that made her rebel against the conventions that were assigned to the children of royalty. What did you think of the exhibition, Desmond?
Some of it was okay. I think that to be successful, photographs of celebrities have to go beyond the obvious. Sure, it's about capturing the essential quality of an important moment, but it's also about the mundane, like in those photographs of rock and roll stars shopping in a German supermarket. They're trying to look fierce, but they come across as short on sleep and quite vulnerable. But at the same time, the photographer manages to make them rather alluring.
I think my favourite was the photograph of Princess Carla. There was a certain power in the way the photograph had been cropped to keep all that energy in a small space. And in a way, it's a double portrait because the photographer's shone a lamp on her face so that you see her shadow in profile just behind her on the wall. I like the way this seems to reflect her personality, the part of her personality that made her rebel against the conventions that were assigned to the children of royalty.
Extract 2.
Do you find it uncomfortable, Bob, when you come up against people who have different beliefs from you about how scientific discoveries should be applied?
Well, maybe I should, but I can't say that I do. Science opens doors for all of us, but then we have the dilemma about what we want to do with those possibilities. That's about society's values and beliefs, though, and science has no special influence in the choices people should make. But having said that, such decisions should be made against as accurate as possible an understanding of what the facts are.
But you do get extremely annoyed with the press on occasions, don't you?
Hardly. I say rude things, which isn't quite the same. I express my sometimes bewildered amusement in fairly direct terms sometimes, but I do draw the clear distinction between my views about things, which I sometimes hold very strongly, as distinct from the cold analysis bit. We need a sober, measured debate where the scientist's voice is heard, not one where people bend the scientific facts to fit their prejudices in a kind of media-hyped pseudo-public debate.
Do you find it uncomfortable, Bob, when you come up against people who have different beliefs from you about how scientific discoveries should be applied?
Well, maybe I should, but I can't say that I do. Science opens doors for all of us, but then we have the dilemma about what we want to do with those possibilities. That's about society's values and beliefs, though, and science has no special influence in the choices people should make. But having said that, such decisions should be made against as accurate as possible an understanding of what the facts are.
But you do get extremely annoyed with the press on occasions, don't you?
Hardly. I say rude things, which isn't quite the same. I express my sometimes bewildered amusement in fairly direct terms sometimes, but I do draw the clear distinction between my views about things, which I sometimes hold very strongly, as distinct from the cold analysis bit. We need a sober, measured debate where the scientist's voice is heard, not one where people bend the scientific facts to fit their prejudices in a kind of media-hyped pseudo-public debate.
Extract 3.
In all the documentation I've read, there's a lot of discussion about how universities of the future will be seen just as partners, rather than sole providers, and how there'll be new forms of accreditation and so on. But one point that strikes me is these are disembodied visions, technologized visions of the future, and there are some major absences and silences. There's very little about the affective domain, and this intrigues me because elsewhere there's a vast literature on life-work balance and on occupational stress and so on. There's been a massive movement in school-based education about the influence of, say, architecture, the built environment, learning landscapes on pedagogy. Very little in higher education. It's assumed that we're just minds. We can work and we can learn anywhere, in any situation. There is some talk about sustainability, and I always joke that as academics we talk about sustainability in higher education, and that we're flying all around the world to talk about this, while there's very little investigation of our own practices in this regard. So we seem to be on rather dubious territory. In all the documentation I've read, there's a lot of discussion about how universities of the future will be seen just as partners, rather than sole providers, and how there'll be new forms of accreditation and so on. But one point that strikes me is these are disembodied visions, technologized visions of the future, and there are some major absences and silences. There's very little about the affective domain, and this intrigues me because elsewhere there's a vast literature on life-work balance, and on occupational stress and so on. There's been a massive movement in school-based education about the influence of, say, architecture, the built environment, learning landscapes on pedagogy. Very little in higher education. It's assumed that we're just minds. We can work and we can learn anywhere, in any situation. There is some talk about sustainability, and I always joke that as academics we talk about sustainability in higher education, and that we're flying all around the world to talk about this, while there's very little investigation of our own practices in this regard. So we seem to be on rather dubious territory.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a zookeeper called Gareth talking to members of the public about changes in zoo practices over the last 60 years. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
I've seen many changes over my years as a zookeeper at Hadley Zoo, and all of them have brought benefits to the animals in our care. For example, the design of animal enclosures at zoos is something that has undergone a radical transformation. When I started out, what was of paramount importance wasn't trying to create an environment which would allow animals to behave as they would in the wild, which is what we try to do today, even if they do still have to be kept behind bars, but it was actually making sure that disease was kept at bay. For example, the floor of the ape house at Hadley Zoo, which was built in the 1960s, is made of concrete instead of natural materials because it's much easier to hose out and bleach down. But we've now tried to make the environment more ape-friendly by adding hammocks and ropes. But all zoos have found that the problem with trying to build a natural environment for some of the larger animals is that when you provide a large area with plenty of shelter and vegetation, visibility becomes an issue to the visitor. Trying to keep both animals comfortable and visitors satisfied at the same time is a major challenge and requires a lot of creativity. At Hadley Zoo, one of our basic tenets is to give the animals what we call choice and control, letting them decide where to move and when. The idea is to encourage the animals to be as active and mobile as possible, but we can't always guarantee results that are visitor-friendly. As a zookeeper, I'm involved in developing programs for the animals. We want to look after them as best we can, but not to fully domesticate them. They're still wild animals. So, for example, we might make them forage for their food, or work for it in some way, which gives them the sort of stimulation they'd miss if we just handed it over. We went through this phase in the 1980s as a profession that, because some of these animals were so rare, they were displayed to the public in zoos in such a way as to make visitors feel that they were looking at works of art, because they were looking at something like a tiger that's a rare and endangered species. These days, zoos are having to fight harder for the public's attention, and we've learned what they don't want is a lecture on conservation issues. What they want is to experience something more personal and emotional with an individual animal. They don't want to treat it just as a rare spectacle. So the buzzword is no longer conservation, although that remains the mission of all zoos. It's connecting. So it's about relating people directly with nature. The idea of showing visitors more of what the zoo does for animal well-being while also giving them first-hand experience with animals is slowly spreading. So the orangutans can actually play with the public using toys which can simultaneously be controlled by the public outside the enclosure and the animals inside. And we've just opened a new tiger exhibit with trails and corridors that will allow the big cats to roam through visitor space, separated only by a glass wall. At Hadley Zoo, we're at the stage where all our big cats and apes were born in captivity and not taken from the wild, like previous generations. They're still wild animals, but they've grown up in the presence of humans in a controlled environment. From years of observing the apes' interaction with the public, I'd say they display tolerance rather than an attitude of fear. Despite their ancestral roots in equatorial Africa, they understand the benefits of air conditioning and they prefer to stay inside, and who can blame them? In the past, handling the more dangerous animals was only possible if they were immobilized or tranquilized, which, understandably, they didn't like. I remember the tigers used to become super aggressive every time the vets came anywhere near them. The situation is different today because we can train the animals from a young age. One way we do this is to train the animals to press against the mesh of their enclosures to receive injections. The goal is stress reduction, so that the lions and tigers become used to being handled and can be given injections without the need for tranquilizing. When I began work as a keeper in 1987, the elephants were kept in chains in their cages at night. And when the elephant manager made the decision 10 years later to leave them to move around freely in their cages, the fear was that it might make them harder to handle. But in fact, because their feet were in better condition and because they could socialise in a better way, it actually made them easier to handle. Things have improved a lot, and I believe animals in zoos have a great life. In the wild, they're...
Now you will hear part two again.
I've seen many changes over my years as a zookeeper at Hadley Zoo, and all of them have brought benefits to the animals in our care. For example, the design of animal enclosures at zoos is something that has undergone a radical transformation. When I started out, what was of paramount importance wasn't trying to create an environment which would allow animals to behave as they would in the wild, which is what we try to do today, even if they do still have to be kept behind bars, but it was actually making sure that disease was kept at bay. For example, the floor of the ape house at Hadley Zoo, which was built in the 1960s, is made of concrete instead of natural materials because it's much easier to hose out and bleach down. But we've now tried to make the environment more ape-friendly by adding hammocks and ropes. But all zoos have found that the problem with trying to build a natural environment for some of the larger animals is that when you provide a large area with plenty of shelter and vegetation, visibility becomes an issue to the visitor. Trying to keep both animals comfortable and visitors satisfied at the same time is a major challenge and requires a lot of creativity. At Hadley Zoo, one of our basic tenets is to give the animals what we call choice and control, letting them decide where to move and when. The idea is to encourage the animals to be as active and mobile as possible, but we can't always guarantee results that are visitor-friendly. As a zookeeper, I'm involved in developing programmes for the animals. We want to look after them as best we can, but not to fully domesticate them. They're still wild animals. So, for example, we might make them forage for their food, or work for it in some way, which gives them the sort of stimulation they'd miss if we just handed it over. We went through this phase in the 1980s as a profession that, because some of these animals were so rare, they were displayed to the public in zoos in such a way as to make visitors feel that they were looking at works of art, because they were looking at something like a tiger that's a rare and endangered species. These days, zoos are having to fight harder for the public's attention, and we've learned what they don't want is a lecture on conservation issues. What they want is to experience something more personal and emotional with an individual animal. They don't want to treat it just as a rare spectacle. So the buzzword is no longer conservation, although that remains the mission of all zoos. It's connecting. So it's about relating people directly with nature. The idea of showing visitors more of what the zoo does for animal well-being while also giving them first-hand experience with animals is slowly spreading. So the orangutans can actually play with the public using toys which can simultaneously be controlled by the public outside the enclosure and the animals inside. And we've just opened a new tiger exhibit with trails and corridors that will allow the big cats to roam through visitor space, separated only by a glass wall. At Hadley Zoo, we're at the stage where all our big cats and apes were born in captivity and not taken from the wild, like previous generations. They're still wild animals, but they've grown up in the presence of humans in a controlled environment. From years of observing the apes' interaction with the public, I'd say they display tolerance rather than an attitude of fear. Despite their ancestral roots in equatorial Africa, they understand the benefits of air conditioning and they prefer to stay inside, and who can blame them? In the past, handling the more dangerous animals was only possible if they were immobilised or tranquilised, which, understandably, they didn't like. I remember the tigers used to become super aggressive every time the vets came anywhere near them. The situation is different today because we can train the animals from a young age. One way we do this is to train the animals to press against the mesh of their enclosures to receive injections. The goal is stress reduction, so that the lions and tigers become used to being handled and can be given injections without the need for tranquilizing. When I began work as a keeper in 1987, the elephants were kept in chains in their cages at night. And when the elephant manager made the decision 10 years later to leave them to move around freely in their cages, the fear was that it might make them harder to handle. But in fact, because their feet were in better condition and because they could socialise in a better way, it actually made them easier to handle. Things have improved a lot, and I believe animals in zoos have a great life. In the wild, they're...
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear part of a radio interview with two academics, Anne Trowell and Jonathan Sims, on internet technology. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
Hello, this is FutureNet. Our topic in this week's programme is the reach and influence of internet technology. With us to discuss it are two prominent internet scholars, Anne Trowell and Jonathan Sims. So, Anne, what do you think about the way people will use and engage with technology in the next few years?
When I think about the future reach of internet technology at a global level, I'm convinced that it is always going to be asymmetrical. Not that technology won't be present everywhere, but that it will be a layering effect. So imagining that patchiness is, for me as a researcher, actually what makes it an interesting world.
Another point, I think, is that many people feel a persistent anxiety about what it means to be constantly connected, whether it's manifested in my child has turned six, should I get them a mobile phone? Or my grandchild knows how to use the laptop and I don't, and she's three.
We worry about what people are connecting to and to whom, but there is always a moral anxiety that accompanies technology.
Because it threatens to rearrange the way we interact with other people, and any change like that worries people.
Exactly. The accounts of when rock and roll came along identify exactly the same current, don't they? A sort of moral panic, with phrases like, have you seen what the young people are doing?
Yes. But for me, what's interesting is the shift in our relationship with technology. This notion that we're moving from a world of technology that we have to do all the work for, to plug in, update, give passwords and networks. It's just a lot of palaver looking after these machines.
For me, it's about how we empower everyone. And for me, that is not just about the technology. It's about how we come up with the possibilities and imagine how it might be different. What we might become with technology as we move forward.
Jonathan, you've been exploring the effect of search engines.
Yes, I would argue if you look at the effect of search engines, in that sense of the internet putting out enormous amounts of human knowledge and making it accessible, we're growing up with a generation of people who will never have that experience of having a long conversation with their friends about how big is this? Where is this? That won't happen anymore.
Right. On complicated issues, we've still got a way to go, but as far as that sort of information goes, we're there. But all the same, when you look back at the 1990s, there was a sort of naive belief that because everyone could be on these networks, we would be connected to everybody on the planet and we would have this incredible wealth of deliberation. And I don't think that's happened.
No. In fact, it turns out that being more connected to one another, more people have voices. Probably makes it worse rather than making it better in terms of coming to a consensus. You're trying to listen to everybody. Everyone wants a turn to speak. All sorts of dynamics. Whoever's loudest, whoever's the most passionate ends up having more power. That turns out to be a deeply human problem, not a technological problem.
And what about the role of technology in providing us with news about the rest of the world?
What's funny is that despite the fact that reporting on the rest of the world has got so quick and easy, we have less and less concern in what's going on elsewhere compared with our own backyards. So historically, we got our knowledge of international affairs through a variety of edited media. And whether that was through newspaper, whether that was through television broadcast, someone went out and said, here's what's out there and what's important. And this was often a really difficult, expensive, dangerous thing to do.
And then someone else edited it and rewrote it before it finally reached the public. But now that's all so much easier. Maybe, as you say, it's taking us in ways we wouldn't have predicted.
Jonathan and Anne, thank you.
Now you will hear part three again.
Hello, this is FutureNet. Our topic in this week's programme is the reach and influence of internet technology. With us to discuss it are two prominent internet scholars, Anne Trowell and Jonathan Sims. So, Anne, what do you think about the way people will use and engage with technology in the next few years?
When I think about the future reach of internet technology at a global level, I'm convinced that it is always going to be asymmetrical. Not that technology won't be present everywhere, but that it will be a layering effect. So imagining that patchiness is, for me as a researcher, actually what makes it an interesting world.
Another point, I think, is that many people feel a persistent anxiety about what it means to be constantly connected, whether it's manifested in my child has turned six, should I get them a mobile phone? Or my grandchild knows how to use the laptop and I don't, and she's three.
We worry about what people are connecting to and to whom, but there is always a moral anxiety that accompanies technology.
Yeah, because it threatens to rearrange the way we interact with other people, and any change like that worries people.
Exactly. The accounts of when rock and roll came along identify exactly the same current, don't they? A sort of moral panic, with phrases like, have you seen what the young people are doing?
Yes. But for me, what's interesting is the shift in our relationship with technology. This notion that we're moving from a world of technology that we have to do all the work for, to plug in, update, give passwords and networks. It's just a lot of palaver looking after these machines.
For me, it's about how we empower everyone. And for me, that is not just about the technology, it's about how we come up with the possibilities and imagine how it might be different, what we might become with technology as we move forward.
Jonathan, you've been exploring the effect of search engines.
Yes, I would argue if you look at the effect of search engines, in that sense of the internet putting out enormous amounts of human knowledge and making it accessible, we're growing up with a generation of people who will never have that experience of having a long conversation with their friends about how big is this? Where is this? That won't happen anymore.
Right. On complicated issues, we've still got a way to go, but as far as that sort of information goes, we're there. But all the same, when you look back at the 1990s, there was a sort of naive belief that because everyone could be on these networks, we would be connected to everybody on the planet and we would have this incredible wealth of deliberation. And I don't think that's happened.
No. In fact, it turns out that being more connected to one another, more people have voices, probably makes it worse rather than making it better in terms of coming to a consensus. You're trying to listen to everybody. Everyone wants a turn to speak. All sorts of dynamics. Whoever's loudest, whoever's the most passionate ends up having more power. That turns out to be a deeply human problem, not a technological problem.
And what about the role of technology in providing us with news about the rest of the world?
What's funny is that despite the fact that reporting on the rest of the world has got so quick and easy, we have less and less concern in what's going on elsewhere compared with our own backyards. So historically, we got our knowledge of international affairs through a variety of edited media. And whether that was through newspaper, whether that was through television broadcast, someone went out and said, here's what's out there and what's important. And this was often a really difficult, expensive, dangerous thing to do.
And then someone else edited it and rewrote it before it finally reached the public. But now that's all so much easier. Maybe, as you say, it's taking us in ways we wouldn't have predicted.
Jonathan and Anne, thank you.
That is the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear five short extracts in which people who have been working at home for some time talk about returning to work in an office. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H the reason why each speaker originally wanted to work at home. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H how each speaker feels about returning to work in an office. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
Well, I've enjoyed working at home for a bit, but I need to get back to office work now. As a town planner, there's only so far you can get working at home. I can live without the water cooler gossip, but if you're going to get a step up the ladder, you've got to show your face where it matters, and I reckon I've got what it takes. And they say they've changed the setup at the office. It was all very cramped before, and I needed to be able to look at maps and things. That's no problem at home. Not that it's always easy to stay on task with the kids' friends dropping by all the time.
Speaker 2.
My company was in the commercial centre, which had its advantages, but I didn't appreciate having to squeeze onto the 7:15 every morning and never getting a seat. And once I'd started teleworking, I found I really enjoyed managing my own time. Then my boss contacted me to say that they were moving the HQ into my suburb, and did I feel like coming out of hiding? And I thought about being one of the bunch again, and I decided, yes, I've missed that, so I said okay. I'm prepared to put in the hours. I'm not sure how I'll get on with someone standing over me, though.
Speaker 3.
The office was handy for local stores, and there was a good library with a book club I used to go to. My workstation was fairly spacious, but there was always stuff going on, and people calling or stopping by. I thought at home, compared with that, I'd be able to get my head down. But when it came to it, I found I wasn't really a self-starter. I needed a bit of a prod from on high every now and then, so I'm not too upset they've asked me to go back to the office. The dog will be sorry. He got taken out for more walks than he's ever had. But never mind.
Speaker 4.
At first, it was just so cool to wave goodbye to the office and to be able to call up my friends or work all night if I wanted. I'd been afraid that once I was at home, I'd get sucked into coffee mornings and fundraising activities. But I kept out of that mostly. But next week, I'm starting back at the office, and I'm like, will they give me enough space? It'll be a whole new team. How are they going to react to a new regular in the office? And then there's stupid things like, how am I going to take the cat to the vet without it being a big performance? Oh, I don't know.
Speaker 5.
My company's just offered me an office job in a local subsidiary. And though the money's not marvellous, and I've heard conflicting reports about the code of conduct they've introduced, I think I'll end up finding the hours suit me better. Here, if the kids are nagging me to get off the computer, it's a double whammy. I can't work properly, and I can't spend time with them properly, so I have to organise childcare. When I started working from home, I didn't really have a choice. My company had decided to shift their HQ right up north, and the thought of uprooting us all was more than I could face.
Now you will hear part four again. Speaker one.
Well, I've enjoyed working at home for a bit, but I need to get back to office work now. As a town planner, there's only so far you can get working at home. I can live without the water cooler gossip, but if you're going to get a step up the ladder, you've got to show your face where it matters, and I reckon I've got what it takes. And they say they've changed the setup at the office. It was all very cramped before, and I needed to be able to look at maps and things. That's no problem at home. Not that it's always easy to stay on task with the kids' friends dropping by all the time.
Speaker 2.
My company was in the commercial centre, which had its advantages, but I didn't appreciate having to squeeze onto the 7:15 every morning and never getting a seat. And once I'd started teleworking, I found I really enjoyed managing my own time. Then my boss contacted me to say that they were moving the HQ into my suburb, and did I feel like coming out of hiding? And I thought about being one of the bunch again, and I decided, yes, I've missed that, so I said okay. I'm prepared to put in the hours. I'm not sure how I'll get on with someone standing over me, though.
Speaker 3.
The office was handy for local stores, and there was a good library with a book club I used to go to. My workstation was fairly spacious, but there was always stuff going on, and people calling or stopping by. I thought at home, compared with that, I'd be able to get my head down. But when it came to it, I found I wasn't really a self-starter. I needed a bit of a prod from on high every now and then, so I'm not too upset they've asked me to go back to the office. The dog will be sorry. He got taken out for more walks than he's ever had. But never mind.
Speaker 4.
At first, it was just so cool to wave goodbye to the office and to be able to call up my friends or work all night if I wanted. I'd been afraid that once I was at home, I'd get sucked into coffee mornings and fundraising activities, but I kept out of that mostly. But next week, I'm starting back at the office, and I'm like, will they give me enough space? It'll be a whole new team. How are they going to react to a new regular in the office? And then there's stupid things like, how am I going to take the cat to the vet without it being a big performance? Oh, I don't know.
Speaker 5.
My company's just offered me an office job in a local subsidiary, and though the money's not marvellous and I've heard conflicting reports about the code of conduct they've introduced, I think I'll end up finding the hours suit me better. Here, if the kids are nagging me to get off the computer, it's a double whammy. I can't work properly, and I can't spend time with them properly, so I have to organise childcare. When I started working from home, I didn't really have a choice. My company had decided to shift their HQ right up north, and the thought of uprooting us all was more than I could face.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left, so that you are sure to finish in time. You have one more minute left. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.